The thing I've learned that's been a common thread through my career by being in industry and then consulting with clients is that you got to start with the basics. You got to start with credibility in the space that you're supposed to be credible in. The ones that can do it well, the secret to success, I guess you could say, if you distill it down, is the teams that trust each other. It's not about having the best process. We just come up with a really rigorous, rigid, best-in-class process. And if everyone follows the process, it'll work. It doesn't, because we're people. When you're exposing yourself to being vulnerable, it means, like, when you're trusting somebody, you're basically being vulnerable to, if they're wrong, I'm going to be wrong too. The minute I say, Mitch, trust me, you trust me less.
Welcome to another episode of Team Anywhere, where CEOs, leaders, and experts at building teams,
companies,
organizations,
and amazing cultures share how to lead from anywhere in the world. I'm your co-host on the East Coast, Ginny Bianco Mathis.
And I'm your co-host on the West Coast, Mitch Simon. And we invite you to join us to Team Anywhere.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Team Anywhere. I'm your host, Mitch Simon, on the West Coast. Today, our guest is on the East Coast of the United States. Our guest today is Greg Spira, a business advisor with Oliver White. He's an expert in demand management and integrated business planning. Greg works with companies to implement lasting change at all levels and across the functions by building organizational capability and developing high-performance teams. Greg is the author of the book, right behind his right shoulder, if you've seen the video, called Trust the Plan, Demand Management for Business Leaders. So today we're going to talk about trust, especially the trust required to build organizational capability and high performing teams. So Greg, how are you today?
I'm doing fantastic. Thanks for asking.
He's lying, actually. We just had a conversation. He was this week. He lives in the East Coast. He was in Japan and then he was back on the East Coast and then he was in San Francisco. He's back on the East Coast. He's lying. But Greg, how are you today?
I am doing just fine, given the fact just that I've been in how many different time zones in the last 3 weeks. But back to work, back working with clients, but had some time off with the family in Japan, so I can't complain. You know, it's always a good situation. Wow. You can balance the work and the life aspects.
Do they have sushi out there in Japan?
A little bit, amongst other things. Yeah.
Good. All right. So I'll make sure that they've got sushi. Variety. You must have exported it. So tell us a bit about your background and why you're so passionate about trust, the first word of your book.
So I started working, you know, in industry. So I was, in IT early in my career, moved into finance, worked in a small, medium-sized manufacturing company, progressively had roles in larger organizations, spent a number of years at BlackBerry back when we used to like type emails on our phones with keyboards back in those cool days. Mm-hmm. And then into consumer goods with Mondelez, so cookies and crackers, Ritz and Oreo and Trident gum and all that good stuff. But in those larger organizations, I spend a lot of time in the demand management space, which is a term, not everybody knows that term,
right? But
pretty much every company that sells something or has demand for their products and services has to deal with. And so my focus was in planning and getting the, you know, organizations, especially the larger companies, to work together, right? So thinking of like the salespeople, the marketers, the product managers, the supply chain folks, the finance teams. I played a lot of like glue roles, having that stitched together. And so learning how to do that well brought me into able to work with Oliver White. And since then I've moved in and I consult and work with clients of all different shapes and sizes. And the thing I've learned that's been a common thread through my career by being in industry and then consulting with clients is that the ones that can do it well, the secret to success, I guess you could say, if you distill it down, is the teams that trust each other. It's the same as sports. It's not about having the best process, even though that's what I thought going in, you know, early in my career, and thought, oh, you could just come up with a really rigorous, rigid, best-in-class process. And if everyone follows the process, it'll work. Well, it doesn't, because we're people. You learn that there's people in these companies. And until AI takes over for all of us, we have to deal with the people side of it. And the companies that have the best people dynamics are the ones where they trust each other to play their positions. And so that's what led to the
book. I was going to stop there. So, yeah. So what you're stating is the obvious, but it's not so obvious, right? Because I know most of my work experiences and situations was we have to come up with the best process. We have to come up with the best product. Mm-hmm. And there was no focus on the dynamics of the team. Why do you think it's 2023, if I look at my watch when we're recording this, why do you think it is still so prevalent that people are not focused on building trust on the team, but instead are focusing all of their energy towards, you know, making the widget?
I think some of it is legacy. I think we're seeing some of that evolve as with generational changes. I think you go back in time, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago before I was, you know, working in a lot of these places, there's some, you know, legacy cultures where you could kind of get away with a command and control or more militaristic, you know, like think about the baby boomers and growing, you know, you're follow the process and like, you know, sort of obey. But I think there's been a culture just broadly in industry of people have options and choices. They can opt in and opt out more, or they can do what they think is in the best interests of the organization. So I think there's an element of that. I think there's also an element of the incentive models that we think of in business. Like remember, people are incentivized based on how they're going to get their bonus, right? And so that's often very functional. And I think it's an area where it's not everywhere, right? Some organizations do get this and can do incentivize and drive with trust. But that behavior starts at the top. I can tell you back in the day when I was at BlackBerry, we had two CEOs, if you think of that fun. And one of them actually firmly believed in like creating internal competition. There was like a belief that if you pit people against each other within the organization, you'll get better results, kind of like internal capitalism. And so I remember that because there's just a variety of different beliefs out there of what works and what doesn't work. And so that's why it's taken me to having seen a good sample size of lots of different organizations across industries my observation was there was a common thread of that internal trust and trustworthiness, because I saw organizations with varying different processes, you know, and I come from a process background and a car process company,
right?
Different versions of it. But then you can see the ones that even with a poorly defined process, but a bunch of people that trust each other, see that a lot in like smaller startups, right? You know, you've got the three founders or four founders and they trust each other. They decide to go into business together. They can nail it. But then you get bigger and bigger and bigger and you start bringing in people that weren't part of the original tribe. And they start to say, well, what's my function and how am I being measured? And all of a sudden you start to get the competition and the competitive spirit amongst people. And that can lead to situations where you're second guessing and creating that sort of dysfunction. So it is an interesting, I think it's something that has to be evaluated at every different organization. So, you know, I wrote the book so people could kind of read through it and see, hey, does this resonate? So far, people look at these things, they read, you know, some of the stories and they're like, wow, that's my company to a T. I get that a lot in consulting. I go into organizations and you can kind of template them, but they're not all exactly the same. But I think there's some common best practices, some common things we can do.
Why don't we just think, go ahead. What are some stories, you know, because I always talk a lot about the five dysfunctions of a team. Which, you know, I don't know if that actually was a true story. It sounds like in your book, a real true story. So what are some stories that we could all go like, oh yeah, I know that one.
Well, so every story in the book comes from a real life example. So none of it's, there's a fictionalized company in there, but I can guarantee you I lived through all of the examples. And, you know, the one I was dealing with just the other day was, and it comes down to trust, people saying, well, give me an example of the kind of classic, you know, lack of trust in an organization that creates these different views. And it's the classic salespeople going out, you know, and finding that they need to build trust and relationship with their customers. But then when they turn them around and look back in the organization that they're working for, how often, if you're asked, hey, what are you going to sell next month? Do they tell you exactly what they think they're going to sell next month? Or is there I'm going to hedge and say a little low. We use the term sandbagger, right? We use that term often to think about our salespeople, and people are out there in the field, or people are holding the bag and carrying a number, and that this person's a sandbagger. So therefore I'm going to put a little bit on top of them, right? Or I'm going into budget negotiation. So I got people are trying to manage incentives or Or you've got, you do have the flip side, somebody who's like, you know, every time they tell me they're going to do something, they never get it done. They're always too optimistic. You know, maybe that's my supply chain guy or my product guy. They're always like, oh, yeah. It'll be ready next week. And then it's 3 weeks later that actually gets delivered. Mm-hmm. So those kind of biases in making commitments, those are the things that everyone can resonate with. You can pause and think, you know, somebody you work with or in your organization that's like that. They just, you know what, you like them as a person, you work with them, but everything they tell you, you take a little bit of off of it. You adjust it. You second guess it. And that's the sort of thing that leads to the dysfunction over time of organizations getting into that finger pointing exercise, you know, like, hey, that, well, at the end of the month, how come we didn't hit our number? Well, I got all the orders I said I was going to get. And the person, well, yeah, but you never hit all the orders you ever say you're going to get. You always get 80% of it. Yeah. So I only made 80% of what you said you were going to sell. Well, what were you doing that for? Well, if I would have made what you would have said for the last 5 years, we'd be sitting in a mountain of inventory. And then, you know, those bun fights that would go around in an executive level debating, you know, who's at fault for the miss. A lot of that comes back down to if you can resonate with those finger pointing, who done it, why are we where we are debates. It's because they didn't come up with a clear plan in the first place because they didn't trust each other to execute what they said they would go and do.
So how do you create that trust? Like let's go to that was the sad story. How do you go to the happy side? What are some experiences that you've had or you're currently creating that actually creates trust on teams?
So, you know, I go from the basis that you can't instruct people to trust, right? Mm-hmm. That's sort of like one of these fun, you got to first say, hey, you know what, if we all work together and we can find ways of trusting each other, life would be great, right? Okay. Now I can't just tell you to do it. The minute I say, Mitch, trust me,
right?
You trust me less. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. Like I say, all those things, those little things that you say to people, like, hey, I'm going to be really honest. Well, weren't you being honest before? Or just trust me. Or just, mm-hmm. You can't just say it. You got to earn it, right? And that everyone knows that, right? You got to earn trust. But then you got to say, well, how do I earn trust? Well, it's how to be trustworthy, right? There's elements of, you know, being a good guy and keeping to your commitments, but there are certain very kind of tangible things you can do to be trustworthy, particularly, and it's going back to the book and the focus from a commercial perspective, because it's really focused on the demand side. There's all sorts of things you can do to be trustworthy from a product development or, you know, any other space, but typically they're specifically drilled down to the sales side of things to say, you know, if you want to be a really progressive sales or marketing executive or commercial leader, what are the best practices of being trustworthy? And break them out, right? We go into sort of balancing and managing your commitments, right? Don't over or under promise down the middle of the road, right? And what does it take to do that? How can you measure that? How can you get that out of your team? I use another analogy of if you go into the bank, and you said, I need a loan. Give me 100. Mitch, I want you to lend me 100 grand. You don't know me from anybody else, but I need 100 grand to start a lemonade stand. I'm going to make a ton of money on this lemonade stand. First thing you're going to ask me for is a business plan, right? Something like, tell me what you're going to do with this 100 grand, right?
Right.
Typically fine. And so people go, yeah, it's pretty common. I mean, nobody would lend anybody 100 grand without, or you know, whatever it is, without understanding what you're going to do with it. So think of, if I'm the sales guy and I say, I'm going to sell 100 grand next month. I'm going to get a bunch of orders. I'm going to go and deliver this 20% growth you're looking for. Okay. So just tell me how you're going to do it. Right. So it's breaking our plans down. It's not just like, hey, if we're a team, you should just trust me. I say I'm going to do it, even if I do it. But there's that extra level of, well, if you explain it to me, tell me your assumptions, explain what are you going to go and do? Salespeople don't love people, generally, in my observation, getting into their shorts, right? Getting into their business and trying to figure out, like, critique what they're doing. But there is an element of just demystify a little bit, share with the rest of the organization the things you're going to go and do, and then do them. It'll give them more incentive to trust and to believe in you. And it's just, it's things like that, like building that trustworthy behaviors. In a fairly prescriptive way, with examples of like, here, if you want to document your sales plan or your marketing plan or your demand plan, whatever you want to call it, with assumptions, what are ways you can even do that? What are the tools and templates, and how should I train my team to do that? That's the stuff we sort of get into. that can then create a much more trustworthy environment.
I see. What is what are some other things about what else is necessary to get to trust? Because we hear a lot about vulnerability, and I'm just wondering, what's the difference between vulnerability and trust?
So it's a great question. I mean, when you are working as a team, and when you have when you're exposing yourself to being vulnerable, it means, like, when you're trusting somebody, you're basically being vulnerable to, if they're wrong, I'm going to be wrong too, right? So let's say, you know, I'm a CFO, and my sales guy says he's going to deliver the number we need for next quarter. And I'm going to go and make that commitment to the board, maybe to Wall Street, right? I'm going to go to the street, and my butt's on the line for that, right? I've gone and made these financial commitments. I'm counting on my sales guy to do what he said he was going to do. If it's a trusting environment and I know exactly, and I trust my sales guy, and I know that he's going to tell me if he's off, and we're going to work through it, but I'm going to believe what he's doing because for the greater good, better that I trust him to play his position and I trust and I play mine. But if he doesn't get it done, yeah, I'm going to be on the hook. It's going to hurt a little bit, right? It's going to hurt because the commitment that I then made based on me trusting him, right. Same thing in a sports team, right? If I'm trusting somebody to pass me the puck, playing hockey as a Canadian, you know, you do that. I might not score the goal, right? Or I might, you know, the team might suffer, but the trick is understanding that on the whole, or in the bigger picture, it's better to put yourself to be vulnerable to your teammates. It's better overall to allow people to play their positions than to try to be that, you know, control everything from within your center. Because otherwise you're going to be in that, you spend all your energy finger pointing at the end of the day when things don't go well. And everyone is second guessed everyone.
Hey, listeners, are you on a team where there's no energy, no accountability, and no vulnerability? Check out Inspired Teams, How to Build a Team from Anywhere, where you'll learn to create an energized, accountable, and transparent team, regardless of your position. With Inspired Teams, join over 1,000 professionals who've transformed the remote work. Don't spend your precious life on a team that doesn't bring you joy. Enroll today at simonalliance.com/inspiredteams. Let's say I decide to add you to my team as a team member or as a consultant. What are some of the things that you do to build trust on teams that you work with?
So there's a couple dimensions to this. I mean, you got to start with the basics. You got to start with credibility in the space that you're supposed to be credible in, right? So if I show up and I've been added to a team and I'm supposed to be a product manager, if I don't have the credibility as a product manager, if I don't know my stuff, that's going to be your first benchmark. So you've got to at least have sort of like know your game and be credible in that space. But then you go beyond that to say, well, then I'm also going to be sort of predictable and disciplined. You know, people can anticipate I'm not erratic, right? So if I say, you know what, this frequency, this is how I'm going to communicate, or I meet when I schedule meetings, I show up when I'm predictable. There's a reliability to it. It's not just that I know my stuff, but then people can come to see that there's a discipline and a predictability to me. Well, then that's going to up the game. And then you can get into the sort of the more interpersonal levels of, well, do I have a low level of self-orientation? That sounds like it's a lot of words there, but it's, do I show up always worried about me, or do I show up worried about the team? Am I willing to make sacrifices that are going to hurt me, but for the greater good? Had examples of that in a large company that was launching a big new product. Big new entrance into a category. It was multi-million dollar launch, and the product guys had developed this thing and it was on track. It was ready to go. But this was probably 6-7 years ago, there was commodity inflation in the industry and the P&L wasn't looking good because they couldn't fight all this inflation that they were having on the cost side. So they were staring at the P&L as an organization trying to figure out, what do we do, right? We're going to miss our commitment to Wall Street. And the best option as a team was to delay the new product launch because there was a lot of cost involved in launching that product. And it's one of those situations where the CMO, chief marketing officer, had to be that team player. Willing, because if he was only all about himself, he would have fought tooth and nail saying, no, I'm going to be measured on the launch of this product. I signed up for it. And that's how my bonus at the end of the year is going to show up. But it wasn't for the greater good. It has to be a person that's willing to say, you know what, for the greater good of the organization, I'll put my objectives aside and be willing to live with that. So think about how that's like a big picture example. I think down to like, you know, I work with a lot of planners who have to go canvas and get information from across the company. I had one person that, you know, she had set up calls with all the salespeople to ask them, you know, for their latest forecast inputs and that sort of stuff. Cause they were trying to figure out, you know, that was her job, was to collect all this information and put it together. And, you know, calling one of the salespeople, you know, she could tell they weren't themselves. You know what I mean? She was going through the motions and she paused and said, you know, was everything all right? And found out that they were going through something personally and kind of like had put the work aside, had a real emotional mm-hmm. connection with them.
Yeah.
That, subtle, but they, at that point they were saying, you know what, I'm measured on getting all these inputs from the sales team and da, 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 but it's not the most important thing right now to that person. Yeah. I'll be late, but it's worth it because you know what, I'm going to build, it's not all about me. It's about the people that I'm working with as well. And so I use like examples as small as that and as big as delaying a multi-million dollar product launch to show if I'm credible, if I'm disciplined, then people don't see me as being in it for themselves. When you think of the people you trust in your life, like your doctor, your hopefully your lawyer or doctor, but like professionals that you go to, your parents, yes. your, you know, your significant other, hopefully. I mean, yes. you think of these people and those are the characteristics that makes you trust them, right? I trust my doctor because I trust that my doctor is not in it to make a buck off me, that I'm assuming he cares about my health. And so it's the same sort of thing, right? It's those types of characteristics that if I join a team, my first instinct as a new person on the team might be, I want to perform well, look good and show up as a star. But the more important things might be to be disciplined and care about the team and care about the other people, which is, I learned that the hard way early in my career. I'll tell you that much. I've got the scar tissue on that.
Yeah, when you start in a new team, instead of focusing all your effort on proving yourself as a sole contributor, it's really to develop trust. And again, it goes back to the conversation we had before. Isn't that obvious, at least in these days? How do you develop trust now when most of us are virtual or hybrid? What are some of the practices that you've seen that work?
Yeah, it's been a really interesting challenge, especially for somebody like myself in this space, right? Whereas, you know, I'm not part of any one organization. I've worked with many different organizations, and I do that virtually now a fair bit. You got to make the extra effort. You can't just focus on, you know, the transactional calls and things that we need to do. You got to find ways to add, you know, is there a way you can just set up a call just to have a one-on-one and just talk to the person? Is there any way you can, you know, if you have the option to go into the office and meet with people, can you add some way to have that? It sounds corny, but team building, some mechanism
right.
to add that is important because if you can't build those relationships, those personal relationships, it's difficult. So I still try to do as much travel, balance the travel with virtual to be on site. That's why I was in San Francisco this week, looking right. through all those time zones, because it was important. It would have been the easy thing for me to try to dial in, but it was really important for me to be in the building for that one session to talk to some people in person, because now I can leverage that. See, there is a balance. You can leverage that virtually then for a while, but you do have to do the investment.
Correct. Correct. So tell us about your book and what would we, why we would consider picking up a copy?
So the book, as we've said, covers from a team perspective and a larger organization perspective, like why is planning important? What companies that plan, what do they get out of it? Right. And they're planful. And then really importantly, it's not just that some people in the company plan, it's that we take those plans and synchronize them. You know, it's one thing to have a sales plan, a marketing plan, a financial plan, a supply chain plan, but it's about linking them together. So you think the first half of the book is going to walk you through best practices around how we integrate plans in a company and why it matters and why it's important and why it matters to the CEO, right? Why does it matter to anybody in the organization that we do this? And it's quite frankly, it's because it lets us, it's the best way to deliver on our objectives. And then we pivot from that into the commercial side of the business, the demand side. That's why the subtitle is for, for demand management, but into like, what are the trustworthy behaviors? How do I show up in a trustworthy manner? What are best practices of demand management that allow me to do that well? And so if you think of like, who would it help? Well, if you're in an organization, just trying to better understand how the gears connect, really anybody could benefit from that perspective. But I think if you're in the commercial space, especially if you're a commercial leader, if you're out of sales or marketing, absolutely, there's a lot of value. This is the book geared to the leader. It's not going to tell you about statistics and the nitty gritty of systems and tools. It's going to tell you what you need to do and what you need to expect of your teams. Similarly for an executive at the C-level, C-suite, any of them. But I also think of it from if I'm in a planning role in an organization or I aspire to get to one of those levels, it helps me understand what should I hope that my boss or my boss's boss is thinking about and anticipate. It's not to mention it's got some interesting stories and hopefully some little nuggets of tactical things that people can take out of it and apply. I teach our public classes and, people will come, we'll spend 2 days, we'll go through a whole bunch of material. And at the end, the most important thing to me is that everybody comes away with something tangible that they can use.
Yeah.
And so I've tried to put, from my experience of teaching the classes and working with clients, the things that people have said, hey, that thing, that template, that way of working, that was really helpful. I've tried to kind of cram a bunch of those into the book as well, so that there's a handful of things you can walk away tangibly and use.
So if there's one tool that I wanted to walk away with from your book, what would be the best tool?
Oh, that's a tough one.
One of many tools.
Tools. There's a couple. I'd say I'd start with in describing a plan being a way to be able to explain, like that, trust me, or go to the bank and you ask for the loan and they're like, tell me your business plan. There's some tools in there that help a commercial person or explain their commercial plans in a practical way, in a simple, easy to digest way. That's not getting into the gory detail. I'd say that beyond that, there's some tools on decision making that can help drive decisions in there, but I'd have to, if I have only one choice, I'd go with that.
Okay, good. All right. So where can we find you and where can we find your book?
You can find me here in sunny New Jersey today. No, I'm, you can find me online, gregspire.ca, as I'm Canadian, but that's the website. You can Google me, Greg Spire, and it'll come up. Books on Amazon, link to the books on the website. And as I said, I work with Oliver White. And so if you look up Oliver White Americas, I'm on that site as well. And there's tons of additional freebies on both my website and the Oliver White America's website of like white papers and other resources, videos, things like that, that you can get and sign up to and cost you very little.
A little bit.
I mean, I'm not an ethnic, I'm not going to be retiring rich off the book. I wrote the book as a passion. Right. For the space and had the opportunity to be with an organization that made it possible. So,
great. I love the Oliver White white papers. That's kind of a catchy thing. All right. Well, Greg, thank you. Forgot about that. So, Greg, thank you so much. Thanks for hitting us up at the end of your weekend, at the end of your week as you go into the weekend. And thank you for your time. Please, as our listeners, check out that book and please share this episode with your friends, your colleagues, family. We'll see you next time on the next episode of Team Anywhere. Before we sign off for today, please take a moment to subscribe to our podcast and leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform. Your support helps us grow, and by subscribing, you'll be the first to know when our exciting next episode is available.